I would tell any young, thoughtful, friendly, you know, psychologist with some angst and insight into his own soul that what one needs to do is to learn to play the guitar. All right.
Lyle, Dr. Jen Hawk, welcome to the 200th episode of the Beat Your Genes podcast.
Yay, with such a lovely intro.
Yay, what a pleasure.
Such great talent. God bless the Jimmy the guitar players of the world.
I have to tell you guys, Jimmy the guitar player who called in last week from Canada, he goes by the name of Warren Taves, and just an incredible gentleman who made a video. Send me the audio for this podcast and just really appreciate it. It's a wonderful talent. He actually got a transcriber to get the music and
wow.
Just it's incredible song that he learned.
Wow. It's really, yeah. I appreciated it more hearing Fabulous. It this time than I listened to it this morning when I saw it on Facebook on my phone, but it's really getting the full audio experience is, I don't get the brooding staring into the camera like a serial killer effect that he put on the video, which was part of its great charm. But it's very, very, it's lovely. So I've never had such fondness for the intro before. I've now been conditioned into great affection for it. So thank you, Warren. It's really lovely.
Just thank you, Warren. Yeah, terrific. I found myself getting a little bit emotional, but.
Yeah, it is.
No, not too much.
Not too much, yeah.
Just fabulous.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, it is our 200th episode. We've been doing this now for about 4 years, and mm-hmm. Dr. Lyle, we've been doing this now for a while. Do you have any? We have some announcement.
Well, we had one announcement. I talked to a ridiculously handsome young man from Australia today. There's like redundancy all over
they
that.
All?
They're all. Just, you know, I'm going to make sure I never move down there. Let's put it that way. And he told me, Jen, that he said, you know, I really like your podcast a lot, but it's much better with Dr. Hawk.
Oh,
how about that?
Oh, that's lovely. Oh, and coming from an attractive
there
Australian at that, it makes it all the better. That's great.
So, at any rate, the announcement is that Dr. Jen Hawk has graciously accepted that Nathan and I have invited her to be a permanent member of our team, of course, a full member of our team. So thank you for joining us, Jen. It's just absolutely grand to have you with us.
It's wonderful. It's really a lot of fun to be here and just to keep you guys in check. So I really enjoy it. And it's been a lot of fun in the small percentage of the 200 episodes that I've been here. But yes, we will have much fun going forward, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Grand. Well, just terrific.
Dr. Hawk, it's been a lot of fun just having you on to start with. And it almost feels like, you know, we've been doing this for 4 years, and at least from my perspective, because I didn't go to Harvard or anything like that, but from my perspective, it feels like, you know, 4 years is like, it's like you get your bachelor's degree, mm-hmm. and then now I get to work towards my master's.
There you go.
with Dr. Mm-hmm. Hawk on. So, it's been incredible, the kind of explanations you give for these answers. So we're looking forward to a lot more.
Oh, geez. Thanks. Thank you.
Very good. Cool. And Nathan, great job. You know, obviously, neither one of us have. Jen's got more technical skill than I have, but that's not saying a lot. I have none. So we rely totally on you.
We do.
So,
yeah.
Thank you for all your excellent
and
work.
And I don't know if all the listeners appreciate
it's a lot of fun.
Nate goes to a lot of trouble every week to pick out questions and get it all organized and handles all the technical stuff because, yeah, we really don't know what we're doing on that end of things. So we just call in when we're instructed to, and we answer questions when Nate asks us, but Nate's doing all the rest of it. So we are very appreciative of that.
Well, it's a lot of fun. It wouldn't be a show without you two. So, Dr. Lyle, I was working on this new intro for mm-hmm. this announcement. So I'd like mm-hmm. to just show you what it sounds like just to get your reaction here.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle.
And Dr. Jen Hawk.
All so that we can discover what life is all about.
Boy, that is some outstanding, really sophisticated.
Pull back some of the
editing.
Phrase.
that's not intro level audio work right there. Like that's really sophisticated stuff. It's really good. Could barely catch that edit. Beautiful.
All right. Well, what's on the docket for tonight?
Yeah.
Today I just figured I'd write some fun questions for both you, and we can just go through them. In episode 100, we kind of had some fun personal questions of Dr. Lyle. So I figured in the same vein, we can do something similar and get a little mm-hmm. more personal with Dr. Jen Hawk. Mm-hmm. And then and just keep going with Dr. Lyle. So Dr. Hawk, this question is for you, the first one, right out of the gate. And that is, what are some of your favorite foods or favorite dishes?
What a funny question. I'm mostly whole food plant-based, so I really do try to do a good job with that. So the answer to that question is not as exciting as it might otherwise be, but I don't know. I'm a sucker for a really good hummus. Hard to say. What a strange question, but this is not what I expected at all.
Think hard because for the rest of your career, you're going to be offered
this true.
Dish.
Oh my God. This is the equivalent of Doug and carrot cake, isn't it? I need to really be careful here what I say.
Oh yeah. That's why I asked.
Now everyone's going to be giving me hummus for the rest of my life. I like to experiment a lot with sort of mixing whole food plant-based kind of combos together. So I do a lot of experimental stuff with different grains and different beans, including different veggie burgers and different bowls and different things. So it's kind of basic, but I like to play around with different things. And I have a little bit of a hot sauce habit. So I like to experiment with crazy hot sauces and salsas. And so I suppose that's as interesting as it gets. But yeah. If I think of something more interesting later in the episode, I will volunteer it. But it's not too exciting in a culinary sense.
Do you use Dylan Holmes hot sauce?
I don't have it on hand. It's very delicious, but I don't actually have it here. And I yes, Dylan should send me some if he's listening.
Dylan from for those of you who don't know, Dylan Holmes, he runs a YouTube channel called Well Your
yes.
World, and just got some really great videos. He's got some interviews with Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, both of them together. I did one interview with him, and he's got I think 30,000 subscribers on YouTube is kind of the last time I checked. It's probably more now, but he has a line of salt, oil, and sugar free sauces.
Yes.
And I think is it sauces? Yeah,
sauces and he's working on salad dressings, and he's a wizard in this regard. And I've tasted them. I've tasted a wide variety of them, but I don't have any of them on hand, which I am deeply ashamed to admit because I really should. So, but yes.
Well, yeah. I got a couple of these and I have them here at Fasting Escape, but I don't have them anymore because everybody ate them like very quickly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So, Yeah. So they're really excellent. So for those people who are trying to get some sauces in their lives, the Well Your World is the place to go. Well, Dr. Hawk, the reason I was asking you is because it has to do with, you know, Dr. Lyle, actually. So in, you know, Dr. Lyle, since you've released your Perfect Personality DVD, everybody has found out just how much you love carrot cake and just how much Dr. Goldhammer loves judging you for eating the carrot cake. So,
yeah.
I can imagine that perhaps maybe you don't love carrot cake as much anymore. So I'm curious if there's anything else that you like besides carrot cake.
Careful, Doug.
No, that's it.
This is a trap. It's a trap. We've walked right into a terrible, terrible trap. We need to just abort the mission now. I see where this is going.
Yeah.
Anything you say, canon, will be used against you.
Right, right. This is one of these things where your lawyer just says, no, no, you don't. No, I just had some carrot cake very recently here in the last few days. And it was once again excellent. So, yeah, I can't. I also like almond milk hot chocolate.
He does. That's true.
That's another one.
Got a so, very soft spot for that.
She's watched me. She has first-hand evidence.
All right. Well, that's enough of the trappy questions. That was just the first fun one. So, all right. This is a little more serious question, and this is for Dr. Lyle first, and then we want to hear Dr. Hawk's take as well. And that is, what makes a good psychologist?
Boy, that's such a broad question. I would say that. Partially, I don't know the answer, and so I think that's the first thing that I would say is that I couldn't put my finger on it. I've met some people now, mostly young people, that are interested in getting into this field, just because they've heard me and they've maybe heard me do some quote therapy on the radio, and they are intrigued by evolutionary psychology and they're interested in making it a career. And of the people that I've talked to, most of them, what I call have what it takes. In other words, if they're this interested in psychological phenomena, and in order to make as much of a study of it as they have, when I've spoken with, I'm thinking about a half a dozen young people, that it takes a certain thing that I call psychological mindedness, and that's an old term from my grad school days. And that's sort of, people differ in how naturally sort of sensitive, generally insightful about being able to infer motives pretty accurately. That sort of just interpersonal skill. In other words, that you can talk reasonably easily with people, that you're reasonably comfortable. You don't have to be extroverted at all to be a psychologist. In fact, I don't think that that's any advantage at all in this field. I think if you're someone who likes to have one-on-one conversations about things that are meaningful, as opposed to superficial posturing of some kind, if you're just someone who likes to talk real about real things and essentially try to analyze, understand, and then improve. That's kind of your approach towards life and interpersonal relationships in general. Then this is something that you have an affinity for. So certainly, to be a good psychologist, you need to be pretty high intelligence. There's in order to learn what's necessary to understand in this field. You're going to need to be able to grasp evolutionary psychology, and you're going to need to grasp some fairly complicated things. Now, it's not super complicated, so you don't have to be a star student, and you don't have to be exceptionally intelligent at all. But you need to be pretty sharp. You know, you need to be a sort of a B+, A-, university student, because you're going to be dealing with problems of people that are sometimes smarter than you are and yet are stumped. And so what's going to make it for you is you need to be bright enough to grasp what it is that they're going through and then competent enough through what you've learned in order to filter through those details and work with them towards a solution out of essentially a problem-solving matrix that is logical and makes sense. That problem-solving matrix that's logical and makes sense is now far superior. The potentials for that are now far superior than they have ever been. And that's because we now have a greater understanding of human nature and the inherent struggles and difficulties and competitive challenges that are giving rise to people's struggles than we've ever had before. But that's new. And so it requires a pretty high level of intelligence to do that. The final thing that I would say is that, and this is, I remember John McDougall talking to me many times. He said to me, "Do you love the water?" And I said, "No." Okay. And he said, "Well, then you're not going to be a windsurfer." And John McDougall was just a fanatical windsurfer in his life. And he surfed in Hawaii. That's where he learned it. And then he surfed in Bodega Bay, where it's freezing cold and full of great white sharks. Didn't care. Okay. Yeah. And that's because he loves it. And psychology, to be a psychologist, it's not sort of an average thing to be doing. It's not just, it's something that you're kind of born with, that you kind of love this type of a process. And so that's probably the most important thing. It requires some reasonably high intelligence. It requires a comfort with one-on-one deep conversation. And more than anything, it requires a fascination and magnetism towards these kinds of issues. And that's what it really is.
Absolutely fascinating. Jen? Dr. Hawk, go ahead, yeah. Dr. Lyle.
Oh, yeah, I'll mention something else. Oh. That when I met Jen, she's obviously knee-deep in a PhD in political science, and yet she was a total natural. And she had all of the things that I just talked about and had them all in spades. And so all of the raw materials were there. All that was needed was whether or not she wanted to do this. And so it turned out that she was interested, and she was inherently interested in the material. Whether or not she was ever going to do anything with it other than for her own understanding was just sort of up to fate. But it's turned out that she inherently is these things. She is a psychologist absolutely by genetic nature. And so, and all of these things that I'm talking about, you know, apply to her.
Well, I appreciate that. That's very, very kind of you to say. I think I mischanneled it for years into my new age career, which is sort of like what I was going to add to it, because I think everything that that you've said is true as far as an innate curiosity about people and comfort with the one-on-one interaction and kind of holding the big picture in mind and incorporating all of the observations you're making about the person and sort of, able to hold that objective and subjective place at the same time. And that drew me into a lot of other types of work that were adjacent to psychology type work, including journalism, including astrology, including sort of deep research for my dissertation that required a lot of interview work. Like all of these sorts of things were related and called on the same kind of skill set, which has always been what I've just been most interested in. I've also been always really super interested just in understanding my own motivations and my own process. And I think that's probably the number one sign of somebody who's going to do well with this, is somebody who's just relentlessly curious about why they do the things they do, which those of us who have that sort of relentless self-curiosity. It's surprising when you realize that not everybody has it. Not everybody is maintaining this kind of meta-analysis position on their own life and their own actions and their own outcomes in the same way that I just always very naturally have, and I know that Doug has too. So I think all of those things are really important. I think to be a successful psychologist who doesn't burn yourself out, it's really important to be grounded in the matrix of true understanding of human nature rather than some psychodynamic paradigm where you are struggling to walk people back through their childhood history and their childhood issues and traumas, which is exhausting for both the practitioner and for the client in a way that's really not sustainable over the long term. So we get to just like some of the plant-based doctors say that they're the luckiest doctors in the world, their patients get well. We are the luckiest psychologists in the world because we actually have a matrix of solutions that work clinically for fixing the real issues that people are facing in their lives, where most psychologists or coaches or therapists of any kind are completely lost in the psychodynamic weeds on that. So we're very lucky there for sure.
Mm-hmm. And we are the listeners. I consider myself, I know I'm the host, but I actually consider myself a listener, is that we're actually really lucky that we get to hear all this wind out day in, day out when we do the shows. So the question I have for Dr. Hawk first, is that in the last few years that you started learning about evolutionary psychology and that you've been curious about it, is there something new that you found out about that you actually didn't expect?
I think once you sort of have the overarching, there's a saturation point that comes with it. So I don't remember exactly where that was or when that happened, where it sort of clicked into place at a level where I really sort of understood the nature of the machine. But you get saturated with the basic rules of how it all works, and you get really truly grounded in the evolutionary consilience of it all. And so you just automatically are running any kind of idea through, does this make evolutionary sense or not? Not that everything is necessarily adaptive in a really positive way, but it's still got to be grounded in that consilient notion. So I think whenever that happened, which was fairly early on, because it was all ka-chunking into place really, really clearly for me, then nothing has been particularly surprising after that. There were a lot of surprises on the way up that learning curve, where, you know, the ego trap was surprising. Like when I really grokked the ego trap in my own life, it helped me understand. Facebook memories reminded me of this recently, where I, sometime in like 2015, I read about the ego trap in a footnote in The Pleasure Trap, and I announced to my friends on Facebook, like, oh my God, I've seen the light. I suddenly understand like all of my procrastination and all of my issues and why I haven't finished the dissertation and all of like everything suddenly kind of came together for me when I understood that. So I was surprised by that. And then, of course, there were other things along the way that sort of I was taken aback by. But, you know, once you sort of get your mind around the idea, you see how it all works. It's like the one idea just builds upon another idea, builds upon another idea. And everything fits so beautifully in consilience that... Yeah, I don't remember the last time I was super surprised by anything. I was super delighted to sort of discover things that I hadn't thought about in a particular way before, but not surprised by them, if that difference makes sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Dr. Lyle, what about you?
I would say I've had exactly the same experience, and that is that yes, I'm not surprised. I am delighted. I continue to be delighted with the increasingly fine detail that comes to light as we continue to work and think and as Jen and I do a great deal of talking and as both of us work with people and any time that you get stumped with an individual that's struggling with something and you can't quite figure out what the stumbling block is. Occasionally, those are the richest thing that happens because it forces your mind to look at all angles around the problem, looking for the dynamics that you don't understand to try to figure it out. And so, Yeah, I what has been surprising to me, I think maybe one thing that has been a bit of a surprise to me is that in the, it was just in the last couple 3 years, maybe no more than that, I don't think, where it dawned on me that that personality was fixed. And so this was not, I can remember reading any number of intelligent reviews, Miller, Pinker, the Moral Animal. If you read Judith Rich Harris, anybody that you read in personality that is knowledgeable is basically saying, okay, 50-50, 60-40, whatever it is. In other words, the genes are the biggest source of variance, but there's a lot of variance left over. This is, these are the three laws of behavior genetics as were outlined by Eric Turkheimer, God knows, in 1990 probably. And it turns out that along the way, sometime probably might have been 2015, 16, 17. Might have been pretty recent. Jen might have been here for
Blueprint came out in 18.
We might have been talking.
Yeah, I think we were.
What's that?
Yeah, I think that was after yeah. It was a little before Plomin that we started to kind of really settle into the idea, yeah. And then Plomin really yes. like confirmed it for us, and that right. that only came out in 2018.
Yeah, I think this. Yeah, I think this is probably only 2.5
yeah,
years ago.
Yeah, I think so.
And so I was puzzled by something, and that is the correlation coefficients on studies that I was aware of for IQ with monozygotic twins were very high, and were the personalities correlation coefficients were quite a bit less. And still very substantial. And yeah, I had been giving that lecture for, if you go back to the perfect personality, I think I talk about that in the perfect personality in, 2006. So this is a very old observation in behavior genetics. And finally, one day it dawned on me after giving that lecture for 115 times. I'm staring at the board, probably at True North, and thinking, well, why is that? Why would it be true that certain neural tissue would be super high in correlation coefficient and a whole bunch of other neural tissue wouldn't be? Why would some of it be so much more flexible and subject to environmental influence than the rest of it? And it occurred to me, that's bogus. It doesn't make any sense at all.
It's
from the
test.
Standpoint of biology. Yeah. Yes. And it suddenly had dawned on me, hey, it's the test. And I had thought about it many times. I'd even talked about it. I talked about how the personality tests on an MMPI, for example, the same person doing an MMPI a year later correlates about the same with two MZ twins taking it today on the same day. And so I had looked at that. And so all these disparate little problems were rattling around in my skull. And finally, one day, I decided, wait a minute. It's bogus. And if the IQs are super high, and they're clearly what we're looking at there is just some random variation in test accuracy, quite frankly, with the IQ tests, correlating over 0.8 for monozygotic twins, and the fact that two IQ tests taken by the same individuals, same 25 individuals take two IQ tests, the IQ test scores themselves of the same individual within subject only correlate 0.7. So there is no magic place to know what your IQ score is. You have a score that you will get consistently on an individual specific test. And so I'm looking at that thinking, oh my God, it's completely genetically fixed. It's not correlation coefficient of 0.8 something. It's just a slight individual variation in life experiences are giving rise to slightly different scores of a pair of MZ twins on an IQ test. And now when we start talking about personality, the subtle differences in interpretation of questions on a personality test just leads to greater error variance. And I remember thinking, I'm pretty sure that the whole damn thing is fixed. And so, and then Robert Plomin arrives.
Robert Plomin arrives on the scene. Well, he's been there the whole time.
Robert Plomin arrives on the scene.
He was there.
And I and Jen may never forgive me because I wouldn't stop reading and I wouldn't let her catch up.
He's like, oh, let's read this book at the same time. And like, we got our copies at the same time. And then he's like, oh, yeah, so I finished chapter two and it's really interesting. And here, let me tell you about it. I'm like, dude, give me a chance. I've got to work. I haven't had time to sit down and read. And we eventually, yeah, literally got on the same page with Plomin, and we've both reread it several times, and read a lot of his supporting documentation and this is Blueprint is not the only thing that Robert Plomin has ever done. This is the summa of a long career. He's one of the original twin researchers, and really kind of founded the whole idea. And then of course you're also applying it to your clinical history and watching people over time and your own experiences. And it's like, oh my God, people really are who they are. This is not changing. This is really not changing. So that has to become just a cornerstone of any kind of meaningful clinical practice, because if it's not, what are you doing? You're completely misguided if you're not realizing that personality is immutable.
Which winds up being one of the most revolutionary insights in history, and one of the most important insights for human beings taking a prescription about how to live their lives. Because essentially, and contrast this with typical modern psychotherapy that says, well, if you're a neurotic, anxious nutcase, well, it happened because of stuff that happened in your childhood, and we got to go back and talk about the traumas, and then we're going to work you through this. That's 27 years of a total waste
of
time.
Less of a neurotic, anxious nutcase somehow, if we can just get this right. If you come in every week on Friday at this time and we talk about your childhood, one of these days you're going to walk out of here a nice, stable, un-nutcased human. And it's just like, this doesn't happen. Doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Yes, doesn't work that way. And so the beauty then is that what we do is we look at the situation and realize that if I have an anxious cat that's inherently anxious, then what I'm going to do is I want to put it in really benign circumstances. So we wind up understanding that what we have control over is we have control over environmental choices. We don't have control over our reactions. And so that winds up being an enormously important prescription. And as a clinician also, it gives you peace of mind that you're not somehow taking out a ball peen hammer and trying to hammer this person's personality into something that's a more attractive or more functional shape. That's not what you're doing. What you're trying to do is you're trying to understand who it is that they really are, understand what their opportunities and their goals and their threats are and their strengths and weaknesses. And we're trying to maneuver them into a clearer understanding, an undistorted understanding of both themselves and their environment, and then look for the yellow brick road to the best opportunities for the most benign circumstances to live their lives. That's what clinical psychology actually is. And literally that insight is revolutionary. That insight is entirely different than psychotherapy as it is now understood. And so that's the surprise to me, if you ask for my biggest surprise, probably. So just to use the cleaver so that people can understand that psychology is broken into two major arms. One of them is general psychology. This is the equivalent of the liver and the kidneys and the cardiopulmonary system and the eyeballs and your ears and the five senses. In other words, those are things that everybody has. So those are the generic systems of life for humans and deer and everything else under the sun. Okay, so in other words, there are parts, and the nature of human biology is the nature of how the human heart and the aorta and, you know, where this fits there and where that fits there and the different chambers of the heart and the kidneys and the liver and what it can do and what it can't do and what's poisonous and what isn't poisonous for this animal. And so this is that's general. That is Gray's anatomy. And so Tubi and Cosmides, when they set out to understand psychology, their goal was to understand the Gray's anatomy of the mind. In other words, what are the nature of the neural circuits? In other words, the motivational goals and the preferences, the natural preferences that give rise to human nature. But there is a second very important question, and it's a vastly simpler question. It's so much simpler that Tubi and Cosmides were really not interested in it. And that's the question of individual differences. And so their attitude was, hey, okay, so what? So some people's kidneys are different than other people's kidneys. I guess that's interesting.
Big deal. Bell curves.
Okay.
Whoop, whoop.
can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
What's that?
Yeah, I said, oh, yeah, they basically, their attitude is big deal. Bell curves. Who cares? Like, it's just
right.
Nice.
Who cares? And so that's just isn't their interest. And yet, the individual differences in personality wind up being where all of the action is when it comes to making choices about who you love, who you don't like, you know, what you would like to do in this life. Where would you like to live? How do you want to spend your leisure time? What career do you want? It's like, these are not questions of general psychology. These are questions of personality. And so so personality has an enormous, is an enormous clinical question. And yet it's one that I, you know, I understood pretty well. And I thought I had a pretty good handle on it until just here recently, the last couple of years. And so the biggest surprise I have had, and the thing that is stunning to me and that I'm pleasantly relaxed about now and very comfortable in my understanding, is that oh my God, this enormously major variable is actually a constant. It's actually fixed. And so it's like, oh my God, the math of the problem about how to deal with this just got way simpler. And so this is a massive insight. And of course, it's along with a lot of the stuff that Jen Hawk will write about and talk about in the future. The Jen Hawk's work will be reminiscent in our future of people that have read The Blank Slate and have and understand the depth of Steven Pinker's scholarship and his incredible frustration with academia in sticking their heads in the sand and vigorously denying, denying the general psychology insights of Tubi and Cosmides. That's one thing. But now we're going to, I'm a little lost, Jen. I just wandered off course.
Just that you know,
well,
there's denying general psychology.
The question had to do with...
But then there's also denying the differences among people and how that contributes to such profound...
Yeah.
Not only individual outcomes that vary, but also social outcomes that you can trace back to these individual differences, which are genetic and fixed. And there's a lot to say about that. That could get us pretty far afield for sure. But... yeah, it has been a huge insight.
I think what's... go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. We're like Seattle drivers. No, really, you go.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I stand astonished, and I guess I shouldn't be, but I'm somewhat flabbergasted at the fact that for all time, humans have been climbing a mountain to try to understand individual differences. And it's been achieved. It's like, guess what, folks? It's been achieved. And it has incredibly important clinical implications. And yet, for those that will remain ignorant, willfully or otherwise, and do not understand what has been achieved, will not be able to use it, and will essentially waste people's time, energy, and happiness clinically, because they will not be applying accuracy to the analysis of people's problems.
Right. They're trying
and so,
to
you know,
figure
that,
out the why.
That hopefully we will do our small part to try to mitigate. But that's a sociological sociological fascinating mess, and it's equivalent to me to the belief in communism as an economic system. In other words, it's such an unbelievably brutal, expensive, murderous, horrendous mistake that human beings made. And this one isn't murderous, but it is similarly unbelievably horrendous. And yet, I believe that evidence will eventually overwhelm it. And you know, 100 years from now, or 50 years from now, or 75 years from now, psychotherapy won't even remotely look like what it is that we see today.
It feels like the analogy that comes to mind is that traditional therapy, it's no different than if you're an alcoholic, you're going to traditional therapy and your therapist is trying to figure out not only why you drink and all the issues that happen to you that drive you in this direction, but also how can we figure out how to make you a more moderate drinker? You know, how can we just really, really make this happen? And how can we work with your thoughts and rewrite your thoughts and do all this kind of thinking that traditional therapy, psychodynamic therapy is going to do, instead of controlling your environment to get alcohol out of it by realizing you have alcoholic genes and you are an alcoholic. And it has just as much implications for people's happiness when they understand the core features of their personality. If you are a hyper conscientious nutcase, you are signing yourself up for a lifetime of misery if you're working for a micromanaging boss, in the same way that an alcoholic trying to work a job at a bar is a really bad idea. So it's like these very practical ways of understanding what your personality is and really accepting that it is not moving, it is not changing, that you can't manage it, you can't learn to stretch it in different ways to make it more comfortable for your environment, that you really have to get your environment right, just like you would if you were dealing with some sort of addiction process. It's the same kind of thing, and this is revolutionary for clinical practice.
Yeah, evolutionary psychology has been described as a superpower. And in my life, I consider you, Dr. Hawk, and Dr. Lyle to be my superheroes. So the question I have is more about personal personality traits. And this is for both of you. I guess just randomly speaking, Dr. Lyle, you can go first. But the question is what would you consider to be the personality trait that has gotten you where you are the most, and maybe also gotten you in the most trouble potentially?
That's interesting. That's a really, it's a great question. And I can point to it. I can think back on my history and see where I got in the most trouble. I almost got thrown out of grad school. Mm-hmm. And the reason was that I was uncompromising about the truth, and I made the psychodynamic fools that were teaching some of the clinical classes extremely uncomfortable as a result of my sort of relentless prosecution of their position and their basic anti-scientific proceedings, and so that got me into some serious hot water. And and I would say that, my personality is, I think that the thing that has, that nothing particular, I don't see anything spectacular, really about my personality that has led to an unusual, understanding of clinical psychology at this point. I really don't see myself that much different than a reasonably curious, engineer. And in some ways, I feel like I'm kind of misplaced in this field to some degree. I think I just didn't happen to like or be interested in the mechanical workings of machines or, you know, anything like that. I just didn't happen to. And and yet that approach of why does it work the way it works and why isn't working better, that approach is sort of native to me. My dad was a mathematician and computer programmer. And so I come by that kind of sort of logical analysis real honestly, as do many people. And so but it's not often that you will happen to find those characteristics plopped in the middle of a clinical psychology, PhD. That's just not something that often goes together. Well, what usually goes together are people that are sort of maybe more open, open-minded, and also, a little bit less stable, and possibly to some degree, I got a disagreeable chip in me that is intolerant of contradictions. And I don't like it, and I'm not pleasant about it. And so, and so I can remember exhilaration reading Dawkins, and yet I don't think not that many other people did, and certainly not in psychology. But to me, it was like, oh my God, there's a logical system right down to the level of the codons. It's like, oh, this is how this is going to work. And that was fabulous for me, because I felt like finally there was a place for me to set a lever to move somebody's world. And without that, I felt like we were floating around, arguing with them, telling them what was logical or reasonable, bullying them into some interpretation. Not that I would necessarily do such a thing, because I wouldn't. But Sigmund Freud did, okay? And so this is my personality, kind of an engineering based combination of some disagreeable and some sort of logical mathematical, high conscientiousness, those things, and not so open minded. So those things, that's the direction by which I got here, and I actually look back over my shoulder, and I can't believe there weren't like 9,000 of us. It's hard to believe. And it should have taken over clinical psychology. It should have cannibalized this field in the last 30 years easily. But it didn't. And it's just one of those things my personality is, I should have been in a mechanical engineering program somewhere. And I just got dropped in the wrong, the sorting hat put me in our wrong place. And just through one chip at a time, one step at a time of being determined to understand more clearly, this is, we march our way here, and we've got something that's really useful for people.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle. So Dr. Hawk, same question to you. What would you consider some of the personality traits that have gotten you to where you are today, and maybe have alternatively may have gotten you in the most trouble?
I think my openness is, it gets all the credit and the blame for everything in my life. I mean, I'm very, very high open. It took me down some crazy paths. I've talked a little bit about it, and a lot of people out there know that I have sort of what Doug is talking about, the same sort of, there's a relentless, it's less of a, his is a little more logical and a little, it's like he's scanning for inconsistency, and it's a little more left brain oriented approach to the problem. I have always been just a capital T truth seeker. I've always just wanted to know what does it all mean? What's the purpose? What's the whole thing? So, kind of ready made to go attach myself to some kind of cult is the kind of personality that I have. And so I grew up, and I immediately started kind of looking for my cult, and I wandered around and I found a lot of different ones. And I've talked about this elsewhere. I just never felt the true resonance of a true cult. It just never quite fit. So the openness kept taking me down these paths, and also kept getting me into some trouble where I would, get myself attached to worldviews or to communities or relationships or whatever it was. Also interacting with addict genes and everything else to contribute to a very colorful couple of decades in my misspent youth. But the openness also, it's staying open to the fact that if it's not all lining up, it's, you got to move on. That's not a, you found some truth, but it's not capital T truth. So the openness was keeping me driven in a slightly different way than Doug's talking about, but still like having that awareness of inconsistencies in any kind of dogma and any kind of thinking about the world, and just like not resting until I found something that lined up and clicked into place. And that was the consilience of evolutionary psychology. Nothing else did it until I encountered that matrix. And so the openness brought me there. And the openness got me out of situations where other people might find themselves stuck for a really long time. Kind of, you know, accepting, a mediocre cult as their existence. And I just wasn't ever going to tolerate that.
Well, I guess it's true. They say, and the truth shall set you free.
Yeah.
Cause some people think that this is sort of a limiting, you know, cynical. I've been told from close people in my life that this is kind of a very cynical
sure.
approach to life. I don't understand it. I don't understand that, but what you're saying makes the most sense to me. So
no, it's very liberating.
All right. Well,
we're
getting ready.
Empowering to understand how it all actually works, and to not be engaged in a game of self-deception and deceiving others all the time, which is what everything else basically is. And so it's profoundly, profoundly inspiring and liberating. I think it is anyway. So it's my favorite cult that I've found.
I think so as well. All right. Well, let's take one more question here. And the question may have a long answer. So we're going to start actually, Dr. Hawk, I'd like to hear your answer first, and then Dr. Lyle. And the question is, if you were going to create an environment where motivation and happiness can actually thrive, what would be some of the first things that you would try to do in that, create in that environment?
Oh my God. It's a huge question. It's a question requires a book. I mean, is this for me, or are you looking for sort of general advice about like what you would do in general for people? I'm sort of like, it's such
yeah,
a,
in
such
general,
a broad...
I mean, we know that your work, which we'll hear in the future, has to do with, creating resilience and setting up, and Dr. Lyle, we've learned from the show and from all of the talks that you've had, that your work is centered around human motivation and happiness. And one thing that we hear very consistently throughout every, you know, throughout you and Dr. Hawk's points is that look at the environment, create an environment.
Right.
And so what I'm curious about is, what are some things that go into a good environment? The first thing that, or maybe some important things to make an environment conducive to good motivation, happiness, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is such a encompassing question that we really could go on at tremendous length about it. But I think the short answer is that it's completely individual to someone's personality, going back to the personality point that we're talking about. So you can't really understand what somebody needs in their environment until you understand who they really are. And so the first step is know thyself and accept thyself, you know? So don't sort of set up New Year's resolutions to motivate you that you're going to suddenly become a morning person and you're going to create your environment to maximize your productivity in specific kinds of ways. And you're going to, you know, transform your life and all of these different prescriptions that you've come up with for yourself. And if you can just get more disciplined and form a habit, this is a big, big piece of thinking that exists out there, that it's all about habit building and all this kind of thinking, where instead of realizing that you're never going to, this is not an optimal kind of environment for the animal that you are to thrive and achieve greatest creativity and greatest space for whatever it is that you have to contribute and whatever form you want to contribute that in. So some people are much more linear in what they want to do and what they want to create and what productivity and success looks like to them. And other people have completely different goals, and it's just a completely different structure. And all of that is getting filtered through the personality. So motivation is always just going to be a combination of how inspired people are to make a particular change based on their prediction of how, you know, what kind of shift in their relative status, their competitive success, that kind of shift might make for them. And then their perceived probability of success of accomplishing that goal. So those two things are are, you know, really shaping what motivation looks like for any human, no matter what the actual goal is in the process to get there. But that is completely variant among, you know, there are as many prescriptions for that as there are humans on the planet. The fundamentals remain the same. You know, you want to get yourself in a process where you are making systematic progress toward an important goal that makes a difference for your competitive success in life. But that's a very individual process. So I said it was going to be a short answer. That was a pretty long answer, but that's
general. Great. It was a very general question, yeah. And I really appreciate you giving as complete of an answer as possible. Dr. Lyle, what about you? What say you?
Yeah, it'll probably sound similar that there's the general theory of mind is that the people all want essentially the same things. So they want other people in their lives for mates and for friends and to trade with. And who those people are and being able to effectively compete to obtain those relationships is you know, critical. In other words, that you're wanting to put yourself in a position to do the very best you can so that you can enjoy those relationships. You want to have your income earning actions be as optimum as possible for your personality and your potential and the other goals that you have in life. And there's physical parameters to your existence. Literally, you know, the exercise that you can do or would do in the environment, the aesthetics of the environment for you, the social potential in the environment. So all of these things have to be filtered through a recognition of your personality. So there are people that are city people and people that are suburb people and some people that are rural. And that's those parameters of, you know, what's ideal for those individuals, those are going to be filtered through. So when you start talking about the environment or what situations would you set up, it's sort of value by value and has its own environmental circumstances that are involved, and those values can all be in conflict. So you're trying to maximize, for example, exposure to possible mates, but you're an introvert. So there's inherent potential, you know, trade-offs that have to be worked out inside of every nervous system. But what Jen was getting towards or talking about some is that a key component of setting anything up for positive change in your life, to set up your essentially psychological environment, is to look for an adventure and achievement where you understand and are not intimidated by the fact that anything that you're trying to achieve, no matter how grand, is just nothing other than a bunch of little tiny achievements. That there are no huge achievements. All there are is conglomerations of little tiny achievements. And little tiny achievements are nothing other than just the focus of attention and effort on trying to improve and get better at some what is actually, at the end of the day, probably a relatively simple fundamental. And so that what will stop us are going to be various traps where we lose our way behind the ego trap, or we, for example, have goals that we're seeking and we don't know enough about the fundamentals. So we don't have enough expert help or enough knowledge to know what fundamentals we should be working on, and we start looking for shortcuts and we start trying to skip steps. And then that gets us into trouble. So an understanding of the nature of the challenges that people actually face, that the nature of the challenges are that other people in your competitors that are having things that you want or they're having successes that you would like to duplicate, those people don't have secret sauce. That they have the very same type of competitive processes that they need to go through as you do, and that the process is to not skip steps, identify fundamentals, find out how you can possibly get measurable feedback mechanisms by which you can see whether or not your improvements in a given area are actually resulting in any improvement in performance. And if you can get that process of achievement going in any domain of your life, then you can feel a low-grade excitement that is self-esteem and self-confidence. Those are two independent, different psychological phenomena, but they are interrelated, and they're core to the nature of human life satisfaction. And so that's what you want to set up. So if you're no matter where you're beginning, if you're trying to open a coffee shop, or you're trying to become a surgeon, or you're trying to become an ice skater, whatever it is that you're trying to display or do, the issue is, can this be, you know, we have to understand, we know it can be broken down into component parts. Do you know enough about those component parts, or do you need help? And then do you care enough about what this goal is and the improvements that you could be making, that you're willing to put in the diligent effort? And if you do, and you put in the diligent effort, and the results are too meager and too small, maybe it's not worth it to you, and that's fine. There's nothing in the world wrong with attempting something and then walking away from it. It's not being a quitter. But what we want to do, so as you talk about how do you set up an environment for success, you set up the internal environment of understanding about the nature of the adventure of achievement. And we sensitize ourselves to what it is that the most important currency of life is the self-esteem that comes with knowing that we've done an excellent job of trying to do this well, and then the self-confidence that comes with seeing our improvements. That's the most of what the best of life is. We have quite a bit of control over that. And when we look for shortcuts and look for magic, or we get seduced into making excuses, this is where human beings lose their way, and they lose out on a great deal of the potential life satisfaction that's possible for us.
Dr. Lyle, we've come to love your explanations. Dr. Jen Hawk, we are loving your new explanations, and we're looking forward to very many, many more episodes with both of you. So we really appreciate you both coming on for the 200th episode, and looking forward to many, many more.
Oh, it's
fantastic,
great
Nathan.
Pleasure.
Thank you, and thanks everybody for listening.
Yay. Yeah, happy 200.
Yeah, we want to thank our listeners. That's a good point. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays to everybody. So we will see you guys. We have pre-recorded the next two shows during Christmas and New Year's, so we will talk to everybody on the other side.
Beautiful. All right. Happy Holidays. Talk to you soon.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.